I don't like to make promises, but those of you who were here last night, it's going to be about the same. Those of you who are tonight, tomorrow it gets easier. So these lessons, we're just scratching the surface, though. I told earlier that these could each be a quarter long, a semester long, a year long study, and you might be able to get down a little deeper, but we are just scratching the surface, trying to really pique your interest. And you all, as the listeners, your job is to take what I tell you, to examine the evidence, and to say, what explains this best? Here, where we're talking about natural revelation in the world around us, there are two theories: the theory of God creating everything, creation, and the theory that it just happened by chance and matter's eternal and it popped up, the theory of evolution. And your job is to look at the evidence and say, which explains it the best? And this is where we are. It's a little bit shorter lessons on apologetics. I mentioned we're missing prophecy and archaeology. There's a lot that we're missing, but there's only so much you can fit in. But tomorrow we plan, Lord willing, to talk about, did Jesus live? And then end with, what did he talk about? Who was Jesus? The theme text for these next, or these past lessons and tonight, is Romans 1:20. And the fact that we can see God's eternal power in his divine nature by just looking around us. And today our plan is to look at the human body and see, can we see God? Can we understand his creation? Now, if I give you some of these pictures, and I ask you which is man-made and which is natural, I think you all should be able to figure that out. You can look and say, oh, Old Man of the Mountains is natural, although unfortunately he's no longer there. Erosion, he fell apart. But why can you look at the other two and say, these are man-made? Well, it just doesn't happen that way. There's design. There are familiarity. I can see a pharaoh. I can see specific presidents. That doesn't happen by chance. There's design there. Yet, when we get to the lab, we have someone who says, if I can just synthesize life here, I'll have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form it from the beginning. Says a lot about us if we're saying that, because it takes intelligence to make something. Now, the general theory of evolution or macroevolution has a lot of tenets to it. Life spontaneously generated from non-living organism or non-living compounds. And it started simple and it became more complex. The only time that happens in our life is when the government gets involved, right? Getting something more complex from something simple. But life started and developed from a single cell to multiple cells. And then you had this divergence through mutations where you had animals, you had plants, and the animals, you had different ones that evolved from each other. And it became more and more complex, but slow change over eons is what this took. A mutation here, a mutation there. And it happens through two mechanisms. Natural selection. So we talk about survival of the fittest. This is going to survive a little bit better, and so it survives. And then mutations are where there's a sudden change. And normally these are due to radiation. Where are we right now in the scheme of things? We are the epitome of evolution. We are what evolution has been going to. But if you watch Marvel and DC, you realize we're just in an intermediate step. Superheroes are coming because of evolution. Someday we'll have superpowers if we give it long enough. Now, we understand that evolution does happen. We talk about microevolution, and the classic is the finches and their bird beaks, or the moss. There's more moss that are dark colored when there's soot. There's more moss that are light colored when the trees are clean. But those are just adaptations within species. We don't see species changing. But I might have to call in a second opinion, get one of the other docs here to start talking. So what are we told? Well, we are told that we start with inorganic life, inorganic molecules. They come together and they form organics, which then become bioorganics. And then we start getting amino acids. We get simple sugars. We get proteins. Eventually, we get DNA and RNA. Then we get bacteria and trees and people. Now, is that possible? Could life evolve from chance? Well, it has been estimated that the possibility of one protein molecule arising spontaneously out of non-living matter is one chance in 10 to the 321st. That's a lot of zeros. Now, anybody here do statistics? Any statisticians here? If you have 10 to the 50th, it is statistically impossible. So mathematically impossible if you're at 10 to the 50. And this is 10 to the 321st. Most mathematicians will tell you that this is impossible. Last night we talked about stars. How many stars are in the known universe? 10 to the 22nd. And this is 10 to the 321. That's a pretty slim chance. Another, a Swiss physicist, Charles Guy, estimated the probability of random chance formation of a single simple protein, molecular weight of 20,000, which is still far too simple for life. And only two elements. Normally there's 4 to 10 in a molecule. And it had 500 trillion chances per second to make any two of the components to combine. He said it would be 10 followed by 242 zeros. Go back to your 10 to the 50th, mathematically impossible. The age of the universe, according to evolution, is 14 billion years. Well, how many zeros is that? That's 1.4 times 10 to the 10th. And we're talking about 500 trillion chances per second, which is mathematically impossible. And we're still 10 to the 242nd. So a Georgia chemist at the University of Georgia said that the initial chance formation of two or three protein molecules is equivalent to admitting a miracle. So people do admit it who believe in it. I will tell you it was a miracle, but I got a book that tells me all about it. What did Charles Darwin talk about his theory? He said if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find no such case. He wouldn't have made this theory if he lived in the 20th century because of what we understand about molecular genetics and what we understand about molecules and proteins. So what is your bias? As we go through this, which is more reasonable? Random chance over eons or design? Two ways of looking at the data. Here is one of my favorite quotes, and it's actually in the centennial edition of Origin of the Species. So the book that started this all, here is what W.R. Thompson said. Now, he is a believer in evolution. He said, as we know, there is a great divergence of opinion among biologists, not only about the cause of evolution, but even about the actual process. This divergence exists because the evidence is unsatisfactory and does not permit any certain conclusions. It is therefore right and proper to draw the attention of the non-scientific public to the disagreement about evolution. But some recent remarks of evolutionists show that they think this unreasonable. This situation, where scientific men rally to the defense of a doctrine they are unable to define scientifically, much less demonstrate with scientific rigor, attempting to maintain its credit with the public by the suppression of criticism and the elimination of difficulties, is abnormal and undesirable in science. So here in the book, he says, we can't prove this. This is a theory. It's not fact. We don't even agree about it anymore. We don't know how it works. He is one of the most open-minded people I have run across, and it is refreshing. I would welcome talking with him and just debating things. But there are theories out there that are not popular with science. One of them I like is called irreducible complexity. Galen, way back, think about ancient Greeks. Galen first described it. There's a gentleman, Mr. Behe, he coined the term. And he uses a mousetrap, where if you have a mousetrap, that is so simple. But if you take one part of that mousetrap away, it's not going to work. But we looked at the flagella. Bacteria are about as simple as they get. We talk about simple bacteria, yet they have flagella, which is a very exquisite motor that we can't even reproduce how well that motor works. when you read about the flagellobacterium, you'll hear remarkable how it's designed. Yet it evolved, but we describe it being designed. We can't even come up to that level. If you have the survival of the fittest, a flagella that doesn't work has no extra help. It's actually probably going to hinder the bacteria, not help it. Same like a mouse trap. You're not going to trap any mice if you're missing the spring, or if you're missing the board, or if you're missing the little latch. So irreducible complexity says there had to be design that put all this together, or it's not going to work properly. Now, there's a daughter to that theory. It's called specified complexity. Now, specified complexity says a single letter is specific. A long sentence, you know, monkey typing on a keyboard, is complex, but it's not specific. If you have a Shakespearean sonnet, it is both complex and specific. If you see something that it is this specific and this complex, it had to be designed. There had to be some kind of mind that brought it out. So if we talk about this, what do we look at? The simple cell. It's just a blob of tissue. Oh, no, it's not. As you study the cell, it is full of organelles that each have specific functions. Some produce energy, some store information, some are making proteins, some are actually moving the proteins around the cell. There are actually systems to get things, pumps to get it in and out of the cell. And that's just a simple cell. Plants, the same thing. They are very specific. They are very complex. But when we think about specified complexity, the thing we normally look the most to is DNA. Only four letters. It's like I give you four different colored Lego blocks, and I say, build whatever you want, and you build a house with it, and somebody else builds a car with it, and somebody else builds a spaceship. They're the same four Legos. Well, with DNA, that's all we have, is we only have four letters. But it codes for all the complexities of life. Our body, all the different tissues. I can't touch on this in the time I want. So I went online, I looked. There is, this is one, Dr. Buddy Payne. He's been lecturing on this for years, and I've heard his talk many times over the years. So if you want, here's a link for one, where he talks about DNA synthesis. And the crutch with the DNA synthesis goes back to, if you heard a Shakespearean sonnet beamed from space, we would have to say somebody was up there sending it to us. Aliens, astronauts, somebody. But we are told that DNA evolved. And when he gets into his talk, just a very brief piece of that is, you need 50 proteins for DNA to do its job, for DNA to reproduce, for DNA to make proteins. You need 50 proteins for it to work. So if this is evolving, you either had all 50 proteins evolved waiting for the DNA to come so they could help DNA do its job, or the DNA was making DNA without the proteins that it needs to make itself. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? It's hard to explain unless you say, well, there was a master creator who created this. Tonight, when we look at reproduction, we're going to talk about sexual reproduction. And similar to evolution, if this happened, going from asexual or budding to sexual reproduction, there had to be, in both the man and the woman at the same time, this evolution. It had to happen at the same time. So you had to occur spontaneously in the male and the female. They had to have both physical, chemical, and emotional systems that wanted to reproduce, that needed to be compatible. And all these string of accidents that we're going to go through had to happen at exactly the same time, or the species would have died out. So I just want to pull up two verses that, to me, as you look at the Hebrew and as you study the Bible, is just, is it scientific foreknowledge? Is it just random luck of words that are used? But in Psalm 139, it says, "For you have covered my inward parts. You have formed my inward parts. You have covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they were all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them." So I have highlighted two words. The word for covered is the word weaved, and we'll see that in the next verse we look at. But the word for substance is the Greek word, or the Hebrew word golem, which is to wrap or to fold. When you study embryology and you study histology, you're going to see all this wrapping and this folding. If you do histology and you look at ligaments and tendons and bone and how are they put together, there literally is a weaving process that weaves them together. I found that just fascinating when you look at this. Job, once again, he talks about us being knit together, where he says, "Remember, I pray, that you have made me like clay, and will you turn me into dust again? Do you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? Clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews." And if you get a microscope, the bone and the sinews are truly knit together. Is that luck? Did Job know about it? Is that God, through inspiration, using the right words? So what about reproduction? Well, eggs are made in the ovaries. It takes about 28 days for an egg to mature, and the ovaries take turns. They just go from side to side. But what's really interesting is if a woman has an ovary taken out, the one ovary that's left says, "Oh, I got both. I'm okay, we don't have to switch." And so it does it every month, but normally they flip-flop. Now the ovary sits in the abdominal cavity, and it releases an egg into the abdominal cavity. But it's got to make its way all the way down into the uterus. And so how does it do that? Well, you have fallopian tubes. Well, they're not always in the right place, but they move. They have little fimbriae that kind of walk along the ovary, and when that egg is developing, they pretty much sit right on top of where the egg is going to pop out. And they wait for it, because you don't want this egg releasing and going elsewhere. You want it to go into the fallopian tube. So that fimbriae moves and sits like a cat waiting for a mouse to pop out of a hole. It's like, "I'm going to get you." Nothing is left to chance. How does it know to do that? In our ovaries, you have this maturation of the eggs. What's really fascinating is they're there very early. So for a pregnant lady who is pregnant with a female child, she technically is carrying her grandchildren, or at least half the grandchildren, because the baby in the womb has all the eggs that she will have throughout her life. By puberty, though, a girl has 40,000 eggs. That's a lot of overpopulation if they all came about. So 40,000 at puberty. But once a month, 30 to 40 of these eggs will start developing. But one egg says, "Nope, I'm the one, concentrate your effort on me." And so the rest kind of back off. And the ovary is sitting there helping this develop, making progesterone, making estrogen. The brain is sending signals down to the ovary, FSH and LH. And then mid-cycle, there's this spike from the brain down, says, "Okay." And the ovary spits out. And you're left with a corpus luteum, or a yellow body. And so it's been developing, spits out, and you're left with this. Now, if there's no baby, that's going to regress and become a corpus albicans, or a white body. Now, on a histology slide, you can see the corpus luteum is this huge scar. How many times can you ovulate before that ovary is used up? Looks about twice. But that continues. Well, how does that work? Well, that scar will shrink up, and almost fully disappear, leaving room for all the other eggs to do what they need to do. So every other month, that ovary is set and ready to go. We mentioned about the egg being released and the fimbriae releasing, getting things in the right place, releasing into the oviduct. The vagina is acidic. Well, how does sperm get up there? They're going to get burned up. It's acidic. Well, they are in an alkaline base to protect them. How did that happen, that it just happened that things neutralized each other? Semen is foreign. The woman's immune system is going to reject it and fight it. Well, semen has prostaglandins that reduce the immune system enough that they can pass through safely. We've all seen pictures or video, probably from health class, of sperm swimming. Well, that's a long way to swim. They get tired. They will not make it based on their energy alone. They cannot do it. So, but they have a substance in there, an enzyme, that tells the uterus, "Contract and push me up." Tells the fallopian tubes contract and push me up. I need some help. I can't make it on my own. How many times did the species die out before the sperm figured out and the semen figured out we need this to get to where we need to be? Now, we've tested things, and we still don't know really how this works, but if you take sperm and put them directly into the tube and there's no egg, they'll just swim around randomly. But if you put an egg in there and put sperm in there, they will make a beeline for it. They know it's there. How do they know it's there? Random chance? Just evolution? Or were they designed? We don't rely on this as much anymore, but back in the day, if you were trying to conceive, you know, you check the temperature, the basal body temperature. There's a lot of things you could do, but Spinnbarket is a German word, but it relies on how stretchy the cervical mucus is. Now, the problem is the cervix is an opening between outside and inside, and you don't want stuff getting inside your belly. Peritonitis is a horrible illness, and it can kill you. You don't want things there. Well, there's a mucus there to protect things, and it is so thick and tenacious, sperm cannot get through it. But right around ovulation, it thins, it changes, to the point that if you're trying to get pregnant and we didn't have all the testing we do now, you would see the change in the mucus and you'd say, okay, this is a good time to try to get pregnant. Well, the sperm, it thins out, but not well enough for sperm to get through. But sperm just happened to have citrate in them that can degrade that cervical mucus enough to get through. How did that happen? Now, when they finally make it up there, and they've been helped because the fallopian tubes in the uterus, they've been telling it, hey, we need some help to get up there. The egg, it's the biggest cell in the body. It's huge. And there's lots of sperm, but you only want one there. But it's got this thick coat around it because it needs to stay nourished. So as it goes through the fallopian tube, it's got this thick coat. It's a jelly layer called the zona pellucida. It's too thick to get through. But sperm just happen to have two enzymes that can degrade through that jelly layer, through that zona pellucida, and get in. How many times did that have to happen and the species die out? Or was it designed? Now, when you get to fertilization, you don't want two sperm, you just want one. And so when one gets inside, what happens is there are granules that are released. And almost like a taser, they change the polarity of the egg so that when other sperm come up, they're rejected. They are actually repelled. And then the zona pellucida, which has been partially digested, will harden up again because of those granules. And it serves as a protective layer for this baby as it's developing. With fertilization, you can see whether it's mom and dad or dad and mom, you can see their DNA coming together and then they fuse. That takes about 12 hours for the DNA to come together and about 2 hours for it to fuse. Once you have that fusion, when it fully fuses, you have a baby. You have a zygote. At that point, it's one cell, but it's got unique DNA, different from mom, different from dad. It's human DNA. It's the smallest you'll ever be. And people will tell you, well, that's not a human. Well, it is. It's human DNA. We might not want to call it a person, which is really what the abortion debate gets to, but it is human. At that point, the DNA is there coding for everything that's going to happen. The child's height, the child's sex, the hair color, fingerprints, all that is coded there in that DNA. And for the next 10 months, that single cell, that child, is going to control everything. All mom does is give it oxygen and food and protection. But all of that process that happens, the baby is directing on its own. It's a very self-controlled process. First off, it says, Mom, I'm here. Don't menstruate. I want to stay here. So it stops mom's menstrual cycles. It ensures its own food supply. It forms a placenta to get that. Later, it tells mom, I'm about to come out. I'm going to get ready for labor, get ready for breastfeeding. I'm going to start labor. And then for the next, 20 years, it still tells mom and dad what to do. So DNA, the chromosomes. Now, this one is a little different. You'll notice there's three here on 21. So this is a person with Down syndrome or trisomy 21. But each human has 23 pair of chromosomes. Well, if each cell has 23 pair of chromosomes, shouldn't the baby have 23 and 23 pair? Well, no, because that's generally incompatible with life to have extra chromosomes. So how do you ensure that the baby has the right number of chromosomes? Well, somehow, remarkably, fortunately, as the cells are being made, both the eggs and the sperm, their DNA gets halved so that when they come together, you have the right number of pairs of chromosomes. How much information is there? 400 terabyte hard drive right there. And that's in every single cell in your body. Every single cell in your body has the equivalent of a 400 terabyte hard drive. That would stretch for miles if we just kind of unrolled it and pulled it out. But it's so well made and manufactured, when it folds up, you have what we call junk DNA that actually is on the outside that protects it from radiation. All the good stuff is in the middle of all these little pockets. It's a very well-designed molecule. If you talk to people who study DNA, it's fascinating. But within the next day, so 24 hours later, we've gone up to 2 cells. You need enough cells. We got lots of cells in us. When you hit the 8-cell stage, it's called a marola, and that's where cells will actually start to specialize. And this starts rolling down the fallopian tube, because you're in the fallopian tube, you got to get it down to the uterus, because that's where the baby's going to develop. So how does the egg roll? It doesn't have any motor. It doesn't have any flagella. How does the egg get down there? Well, the fallopian tube moves it. Well, how does it do that? Well, the fallopian tube has these little cilia lining. Now, on this, those are actually thousands in aggregate. They are so small, you can't see them. If you want to see a cilia, you got to get an electron microscope and look to see them. But thousands of them come together. And so they will walk the egg to the uterus. How do they do that? Well, are they like the little blow-up guys, you know, where you see them just kind of waving? They could do that. They could be like windshield wipers, just beating back and forth. None of that's going to get the egg moving where it needs to be. The first wave ever done was not in a stadium. It was in the fallopian tubes. They actually will do metachronous motion, and they will just move like waves, washing that egg down to the uterus. I am so glad it evolved that way. Or is it a creator? And that's something you have to look at the evidence and make that decision for yourself. By day or 5 or 6, we're starting to get some specialization, and we're starting to get some fluid that collects inside this developing baby. And this is where we start getting differentiation or specialization, because each cell has the Encyclopedia Britannica of DNA, but the muscle cell says, well, I want to read from the M's, and the skin cell says, well, I want to read from the S's. Well, at this point, the cells say, well, I'm going to be baby, you be placenta. And that's where we first start specializing. So by day 6 to 7, we have implantation, which is amazing because mom's uterus does not like foreign bodies. And this child has different DNA than mom. The body's immune system knows that is not me, get rid of it. But mom's uterus does not reject the baby, because the placenta that has been developing, that's invading in, it has things to suppress mom's immune system. Neurokinin B, small lymphocyte support cells. And so they tell mom, just like if we do an organ transplant, we have to put people on immunosuppression. They do that to the uterus locally. So as the placenta invades into the uterus, these blood vessels invade into mom's uterus, but not too far, or she'll bleed to death. They have to invade just right. And these are pretty good sized arterioles. They got to seal really well, because that's a lot of blood pumping. And if they don't seal well, mom's going to bleed to death, baby's going to die. And through the placenta, oxygen and nutrients, even antibodies will pass through. Mom gives the baby a passive immunity for when the baby's born. Now the baby, even at this early stage, is making transferrin to help move iron. And oxygen doesn't like to let go and cross from mom's blood into the baby's blood. It just doesn't happen. How does it get there? Well, the baby has a different hemoglobin than mom. It has something called fetal hemoglobin. And the reason we call it fetal is because you only see it in babies. And it has a higher affinity for oxygen than mom's hemoglobin does. And so it's like in an arm wrestling competition. One's a lot stronger than the other, and it says, I'm taking all the oxygen. So the baby gets oxygen. How did that happen? By random chance or design? Now, through this, I'm going to have some rabbit trails just because there's so much information, and you got to hear it all. Well, you don't have to, but I appreciate you listening. So immune function. I'm going to give you a two-minute course. Well, in 2 minutes, I'm going to give you a year-long immunology course. So just, you know, buckle your seatbelts. We have white cells that will start rolling in the bloodstream. And then eventually they kind of stick, and then they'll squeeze out into the cell, and they become what's called a macrophage. And they are seek and destroy. They are going to look in tissues, and they're going to destroy things. And then when they find things, they break them up. And the way I explain it to my patients is if you have a stormtrooper that you're looking for, and you can find, you know, somebody has the helmet, somebody has the boot, somebody has a gun, and they're holding up individual pieces saying, anybody recognize this? And somebody says, I recognize that helmet. Okay, go get it. I recognize that boot. Okay, go get it. So the immune system will take it to the lymphocyte, the antigen-presenting cell. Then they will go to the lymph node. And with the lymph nodes, the lymph system brings stuff from the tissues there. And if you have the right antigen, hey, do you recognize this? Yeah, I recognize it. We'll fight it. It gets big as it's making antibodies. It swells. But you don't want to rely on a slow-moving system. So you also have, in addition to the lymphatic vessels, you're going to have blood vessels that bring blood in and out to move stuff around the body quicker. And this is about the simplest diagram I could find on antigen-presenting cells. So there is something, a pathogen or what we call an antigen, that the macrophage finds, and it will ingest it, break it apart, and then it presents it to the different cells. And depending on if it's a peptide or if it's a glycoprotein, there's different cells that are there. Now, some of these will make antibodies. Some of them just go over and say, you know, you're infected with a virus. There's not a good antibody for this, so you're just going to have to kill yourself, cell, and we'll deal without you because you're infected with virus. So there's different parts of the immune system that work well. And it's complex. This is a very simple diagram, to be honest, on how the signaling does. The one that we typically give the medical students and tell them to memorize is something like this, where you can see there are receptors that are on the outside spanning this membrane. Inside, there is a whole host of signaling. It's like playing the game of telephone, with about 17 people all in the same different directions. But the whole goal is to get the right message to the right place. And then there are feedback loops that say, oh, this is going on, we need to ramp up production. Oh, we got enough, let's slow it down. But all of that goes on to get into the cell's nucleus to make the right proteins, whether it's antibodies or turn on this or turn off this. It's very complex. And each year, it gets more complicated as you discover more signaling. It's getting harder and harder to know what's what. Thankfully, there are smart people who are doing this and telling us what we need to worry about. Like, oh, worry about this one, but not this one. Okay. In my job, though, we use the antibodies that are made. So when you have antibodies, there are these Y-shaped molecules. There's an end that attaches to the antigen or to the target. And then the tail, like a lightning bug, tells the immune system, I got the tiger right here. Come shoot him. I'm holding him. And so they get the immune system running. And we make antibodies to fight different type of cancers in my line of work. But we also try to get you to make antibodies when we're fighting measles and mumps and polio. How do you get so many antibodies? Because there's only a short little section of DNA. In the body. There's a little section of DNA that says, let's make antibodies. Well, they will rearrange, and you notice there's a loop here. Well, depending on how that loop is and what gets, it's like somebody sewing, and they're like, well, this is way too long. Nobody will notice if we sew it together, so cut out little sections here, and we'll just sew it all together, and it'll be the right length. Somebody else is doing the same thing, but they make cuts in different areas. Somebody else is doing it with different cuts. You end up with the same length, but much different cloths when you put them all together. And that's what our immune system does. So we have thousands of antibodies that we are making all through this luck that we designed, that we inherited through evolution. How does the immune system work? Well, this is actually a white cell ingesting bacteria. It's kind of going through the blood, cleaning up things. Sometimes your immune system, this is probably hard to see, but that's malaria in a red cell. So the immune system has to figure out, well, how do you get rid of malaria? It's in, oh, well, maybe the white cell will just gobble up some of these red cells. You don't want that doing that all the time. You'll run out of blood. So how do you get the immune system to stop when it's supposed to and start when it is? How do you live without an immune system? In a bubble. You can't. You will die without an immune system. So how did we survive unless the immune system evolved at the same time we did, simultaneously? But let's get back to the baby. So 3 weeks in, but before that, on day 9, the placenta is making beta-HCG. That's the pregnancy test. So beta-human chorionic gonadotropin. At this point, the primitive placenta is telling the ovaries. So the placenta is telling mom's ovaries, I am here, make progesterone, or I'm gonna get flushed out with the menstruation. I need to be here, make progesterone. So the baby, even at 9 days, is controlling mom. At day 13, the placenta is already circulating blood. Randy will be happy to hear that by day 18, there's a primitive heart beating. So just 18 days in, the heart is already beating. Most of the time, mom doesn't even know she's pregnant yet. By day 21, the heart is beating in a closed circulatory system. So before, it's just beating and moving fluid around. Now, it's completely enclosed. The early body knows what to do. How does it know to start with the heart, because I need blood, and not start making toes? It's got to get the right DNA at the right sequence. It's important to get the circulatory system, then the nervous system. How does it know that? By week 4, things are progressing rapidly. The heart is really pumping. The brain and spinal cord are growing at a phenomenal rate. We mentioned folding. You can see things are folding because the growth is so fast, the rest of the tissues are having a hard time keeping up. By week 5, you can already see there's a little limb bud there and a little limb bud here. We're starting to get some legs and arms. We can see an eye forming. We can see the brain forming. But we can see this huge heart. Even a half a week later, it's already starting to look like us. You can see the little paddle hands and feet, and the eye already has pigment. By week 6, okay, we're unmistakably human. And by week 7, all vital organs are present. By 8 weeks, the placenta is making enough progesterone. If mom has to have surgery and the ovaries are taken out, the baby will still survive. The pregnancy will continue because the placenta is making the progesterone. By 8 weeks, the brain and all body systems are in place. By 8 weeks, if you put something in the baby's hand, it will grab it. By the end of the 8 weeks, the baby is called a fetus. Now, you've heard on news and probably talking to people, it's not a baby, it's a fetus. It's a fetus, it's not a human. Anybody speak Latin? Fetus. It's Latin for a young one. The people who named this eons ago, hundreds of years ago, they knew it was a young one, and they used the Latin term for it. By week 10, you got fingerprints and footprints. What we don't understand is why identical twins have different fingerprints. But that starts at week 10. So this is 10 and a half weeks. It doesn't project too well. I have to let everybody look at mine or go online and look at it. But from this point, you're just getting bigger and bigger. By 12 weeks, all body systems and organs are formed. It's just getting bigger and fine-tuning. So for birth, you got this baby, it's just really cramped in there. There's not much room. Time to come out. How do you get such a big baby out of a small pelvis? You can't. It's too small. baby's going to die. It won't be able to come out. But somehow the placenta has evolved the ability to make collagenase, which will digest three of the joints in the pelvis. That's why mom walks like a duck, you know, that kind of waddle that you do. Because the baby has said, I'm getting ready to come out. I need more room. I need space to do this. And it actually will partially degrade some of those joints. When did that evolve? Or was it designed? So, at birth, what important things happen? Nothing neurologically important. All you're changing is where you're getting your food and your oxygen. So, while the baby's in, you got the umbilical veins and arteries, and they're moving the blood around, and you notice we're bypassing the lungs. There are some shunts there because we don't need to oxygenate the lungs because they're not breathing oxygen. They're in amniotic fluid. But as soon as birth happens and we pull that low-pressure system out, the pressures in the heart change, the lungs fill up, the little hole in the heart, that's mostly, for most people, seals shut. Sometimes it doesn't seal shut, and then later in life we might have to correct it. But all that's doing is changing where your oxygen is coming from. How do you get your oxygen in the womb? You have an umbilical cord. Why is it always weird and twisty? Well, it's because the arteries are longer than the cord, which is really important. If it stretches, it gets pulled. You don't want to pull, you know, like vacuuming. You don't want to get too far from the wall or you pull the cord out. Same thing with a baby. You want the cord to not get disconnected if the baby twists and moves. It's got something called Wharton's jelly on it. It keeps it in place and keeps it from kinking. What's really cool is after birth, the drop in temperature from being inside a mom to outside a mom causes the cord to crimp down to the point that technically you don't even need to clamp a cord. It will auto clamp on its own. I tell my patients, pregnancy is the biggest wound humans get and live to tell the tale. And a woman should bleed to death. But the muscles in the uterus, the baby suckling will actually cause the uterus to cramp even more, to crimp down on those. All of that appears to be very well designed. When we think about that, there are 20 arteries that are in the placenta pouring a half a quart of blood every minute through the placenta. But after birth, the placenta just falls apart. It's very fragile. But it supports that kind of volume of blood flow. Now, along my lines of work, how do you clot? Well, if you want to make a wall, you need bricks and mortar. And so for us, we got platelets or the bricks, and the mortar is all of our clotting factors. I told you we're going to do some rabbit trails. So clotting factors, you have different ways of starting them. And believe it or not, it gets more complex than that. There's all these feedbacks. And so if you have a hole in your blood vessel, you don't want to bleed to death. You have a hole there. So the body says, oh, nope, I'm going to put a temporary patch. It's going to sit there until you fix the blood vessel, and then we'll tear down the patch. The platelets, they actually will change shape to do different things as well. How do they know what to do and how to hold on to each other and how to aggregate? It's complex, just like everything else we've looked at, just like the immune system, is very complicated. How do clots dissolve? I tell my patients, if you build a wall with bricks and mortar, but you're not sure if you want it, you put little sticks of dynamite in it. So if you're like, well, I don't need it, we light the dynamite, wall blows up, we get the little fragments out. It's exactly what a clot does. It has anti-clotting factors built into the clot, so when you don't need it anymore, they will dissolve the clot. Is that designed? Did that happen by random chance? I got a couple more things, just because I find this fascinating. The kidney. This filters all of your blood and makes urine. Is that all it does? Well, actually, no. It's constantly moving electrolytes and fluid and molecules in and out. It's changing your urine as it's making it. It regulates your body's blood pressure long term. It regulates your fluid balance, your pH. My patients who have kidney failure all are anemic. Why? Because it makes erythropoietin, which is the signal that tells the bone marrow, hey, make more blood. The bone marrow is not smart enough to make it on its own. It's got to be told. The kidneys make vitamin D to keep your bones strong. They make renin to keep your fluid balance. It interacts with all these organs, and the brain and the heart and the adrenal gland will all tell it different things to do. How did it develop on its own? Like, when did the system, okay, I got a heart, it's beating, but now I got a kidney, and how are they going to talk? How did that happen through random chance through eons? Here's a really fun one. The difference between cholesterol, being a boy, and being a girl, it's all the same molecule. You look at these, they're all the same except little tiny side chains. So very little tiny changes in this complex molecule are what distinguish between being a layer of cholesterol in a cell wall, being testosterone, being estrogen. Is that very useful? Oh, it's amazing. You don't have to do a lot. You just change little side chains and you got what you need. Did that happen by chance? Or was that designed? And to finish, I got to show you my favorite cell. I know it's weird, but it's called the podocyte. And it's one of these big cells with all these little, like sea urchin, little arms going out. And here's one, and here's one. But what do? Well, you notice they kind of line up and interdigitate with other ones. They make these little fingers. And so if you're filtering blood in the kidney and making urine, you want just the fluid to come out. You don't want all the cells because your body works really hard on making cells. You got to preserve those. How does it do it? Well, thankfully, the kidney just happened to evolve a podocyte that covers this collection of blood vessels. And these fingers will actually interdigitate. And so if we look on a microscopic level, scanning electron microscope, they leave just enough space for fluid to come out, but trap all the proteins where they're supposed to be. And if you have a problem with your kidneys, you'll start losing protein, and that can kill you. And so everything just has to work just perfectly. So as you study, and as I've studied the human body, in medical school, I mentioned this the other night, a lot of my professors would say, isn't it amazing how Mother Nature designed us? And we all agree, we were designed. You can't look at the human body and not feel it was designed. But they just attributed it to the wrong source. And what I'm left with is what the psalmist was left with. It says, O Lord, how many are your works? In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. Thank you for listening. For some of you, I might have been over your head. For some of you, I was probably under your head. But either way, I hope you realize just how amazing, both from last night, a world and a universe that we live in, and tonight, just how amazing our body is. I tell people it couldn't have happened by chance. There was a design there. And the nice thing is the designer has given us his diary. He has told us what he wants us to do. He's told us how he wants us to be. And he's told us how to be with him. Because none of us have made him happy. We have all turned our back on him. We've all sinned. But thankfully, the designer sent his son to save us. And if you have a need to make it right with the designer, you can do it any time, but we're not promised tomorrow. So this is the best time to do it if you have a need. So whether you want to become a Christian or whether you have something that you need the prayers of the congregation, please come forward as we stand and sing.